Chapter 2. Attention, I have not been revolutionary in my writings. The revolutionary spirit is mighty convenient in this, that it frees one from all scruples as regards ideas. Its hard, absolute optimism is repulsive to my mind by the menace of fanaticism and intolerance it contains. No doubt one should smile at these things, but, imperfect aesthete, I am no better philosopher. All claim to special righteousness awakens in me that scorn and danger from which a philosophical mind should be free. I fear that trying to be conversational I have only managed to be unduly discursive. I have never been very well acquainted with the art of conversation, that art which, I understand, is supposed to be lost now. My young days, the days when one's habits and character are formed, have been rather familiar with long silences. Such voices as broke into them were anything but conversational. No, I haven't got the habit. Yet this discursiveness is not so irrelevant to the handful of pages which follow. They, too, have been charged with discursiveness, with disregard of chronological order which is in itself a crime, with unconventionality of form which is an impropriety. I was told severely that the public would view with displeasure the informal character of my recollections. Loss, I protested, mildly. Old I begin with the sacramental words, I was born on such a date in such a place. The remoteness of the locality would have robbed the statement of all interest. I haven't lived through wonderful adventures to be related seriatim. I haven't known distinguished men on whom I could pass fatuous remarks. I haven't been mixed up with greater scandalous affairs. This is but a bit of psychological document, and even so, I haven't written it with a view to put forward any conclusion of my own. But my objector was not placated. These were good reasons for not writing at all, not a defense of what stood written already, he said. I admit that almost anything in the world, would serve as a good reason for not writing at all. But since I have written them, all I want to say in their defense is that these memories put down without any regard for established conventions have not been thrown off without system and purpose. They have their hope and their aim. The hope that from the reading of these pages there may emerge at last the vision of a personality, the man behind the books so fundamentally dissimilar as, for instance, Almayer's Folly and the Secret Agent, and yet a coherent, justifiable personality both in its origin and in its action. This is the hope. The immediate aim, closely associated with the hope, is to give the record of personal memories, by presenting faithfully the feelings and sensations connected with the writing of my first book, and with my first contact with the sea. In the purposely mingled resonance of this double strain, a friend here and there will perhaps detect a subtle accord. J.C. K. A personal record, books may be written in all sorts of places. Verbal inspiration may enter the berth of a mariner on board a ship frozen fast in a river in the middle of a town. And since saints are supposed to look benignantly on humble believers, I indulge in the pleasant fancy that the shade of old Flaubert, who imagined himself to be, among other things, a descendant of Vikings, might have hovered with amused interest over the docks of a 2,000-ton steamer called the Adowa, on board of which, gripped by the inclement winter alongside a quay in Rouen, the 10th chapter of Lemaire's Folly was begun. With interest, I say, for was not the kind Norman giant with enormous mustaches, and a thundering voice the last of the romantics? Was he not, in his unworldly, almost ascetic, devotion to his art, a sort of literary, saint-like hermit? It has said at last, apostrophe said Nina to her mother, pointing to the hills behind which the sun had sunk. These words of Almayer's romantic daughter I remember tracing on the gray paper of a pad which rested on the blanket of my bed place. They referred to a sunset in Malayan Isles, and shaped themselves in my mind, in a hallucinated vision of forests and rivers and seas, far removed from a commercial, and yet romantic town of the Northern Hemisphere. But at that moment the mood of visions and words was cut short by the third officer, a cheerful and casual youth, coming in with a bang of the door and the exclamation, "You've made it jolly warm in here." It was warm. I had turned on the steam heater, after placing a tin under the leaky water cock, for perhaps you do not know that water will leak where steam will not. I am not aware of what my young friend had been doing on deck all that morning, but the hands he rubbed together vigorously were very red, and imparted to me a chilly feeling by their mere aspect. He has remained the only banjoist of my acquaintance, and being also a younger son of a retired colonel, the poem of Mr. Kipling, by a strange aberration of associated ideas, always seems to me to have been written with an exclusive view to his person. When he did not play the banjo, he loved to sit and look at it. He proceeded to this sentimental inspection, and after meditating a while over the strings under my silent scrutiny, inquired airily, "What are you always scribbling there, if it's fair to ask?" It was a fair enough question, but I did not answer him, and simply turned the pad over with a movement of instinctive secrecy. I could not have told him he had put to flight the psychology of Nina Almayer, her opening speech of the 10th Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.